Hi, everybody. Welcome to First Thursday, the monthly podcast from Labor Relations Information System. I'm Rick Polson. I'm the executive director of LRIS, and I'm going to be your host for the next hour or so as we discuss recent developments in the world of public safety labor relations. This month, we're going to talk about a couple of different issues that are pressing. One is speech. There have been so many speech cases that have come down recently. Primarily involving officers or other public safety folks who are saying stuff on social media and get disciplined as a result of it. But there's a really interesting one out of Pennsylvania, out of suburban Philadelphia, not too far from my house, that involves a prior restraint of some pretty interesting speech. And we're going to talk about that case. And we're also going to talk about use of force standards and specifically Barnes v. Felix, a really important case that the U.S. Supreme Court is considering and just conducted argument on a few weeks ago. And we're going to be joined in that discussion by Lance LaRusso, who is a fantastic use of force attorney who is based out of Georgia. And so all that good stuff at a check-in of what's happening with LRAS when we come back. First, what's going on with LRIS? Well, we did our union leadership seminar in Las Vegas last month. It was fantastic. And we are going to go to Nashville. Some people don't like Las Vegas. And they said, we want to go someplace else. We said, where do you want to go? And Nashville was number one. Like, there wasn't a close number two. It's really crazy. We're going to be back in Nashville at the end of March for our collective bargaining seminar. That one's really fun because we have a union negotiator and we have a management negotiator, and they kind of go like point counterpoint on all aspects of collective bargaining. We also have a labor economist who's going to talk about finding the money. And we also have me. I'm going to talk about some things as well with respect to comparables. And it should be a fun one, and we'll be in a different place. So if you're sick of Vegas and you want to come east, come join us in Nashville. Then we will be back in Las Vegas in June for our Rights of Police seminar. Of course, you can get information on all of that stuff at www.lris.com. Now, let's talk about a case. This is a speech case that was decided just a few weeks ago. I think at the end of January, it comes out of the Third Circuit. It's called FOP, Pennsylvania State Lodge versus Springfield Township. And this case involves one of these things, the thin blue line American flag, which I thought was pretty straightforward. You know, we support police. But some people may think it's a little worse than that, or some people in Springfield Township, apparently. And this case is a pretty interesting expression case involving what we call a prior restraint. So I want to talk a little bit about that. So where does it all start? So Springfield Township is a leafy suburb just northwest of the city of Philadelphia in Pennsylvania. Springfield Township's township building is like 3 or 4 miles from my house. It's crazy that there's a decision that's so close to where I am. It's a great place to live. Typical suburban city department, right? Lots of workload. And because it's an inner ring suburb, there's maybe a little more crime that you might think, but generally a really nice place to live. The department's about 40 officers, so a typical suburban department. We don't have full-time union staff, full-time police union staff there. So the officers who are working are the ones who are also dealing with grievances and negotiating the contract and that type of stuff, right? It's this extra responsibility, which I think a lot of our listeners, you know, bear that, right? And so that's the type of department that we're in. Why does it matter? Why do I talk about the Springfield Police Association and how they're run? Well, because this case involves the Springfield Police Association's logo. At some point within the last few years, the association developed a new logo, right? And so this is, again, this is not a sophisticated 5,000 member organization, right? They got somebody who had some talent and interest and time to update the logo, right? It's hard to get anybody to do anything, local associations, but somebody, updated the logo, and their new logo incorporated the thin blue line flag. Nobody thought much of it other than, hey, great, thanks for doing the logo. And they put it a couple different places, including on a bulletin board in the police department. And somehow, some township a representative becomes aware of the thin blue line flag, and they are horribly offended, apparently. And it comes up at the supervisor level, and one of the elected officials complains that this flag is inappropriate. It has racist connotations. The flag stands for the lack of transparency in policing, and represents a wedge between police officers and the communities that they police. All this stuff, right? And meanwhile, the guy's like, "No, it's just like a we support the police logo. It's our logo. We're still your neighborhood police officers. We're still we get along with everybody and do a good job." But the elected officials, or at least one or two of the elected officials, got the idea that this was inappropriate, and we were still kind of in the this is suburban Philadelphia. Lots of a kind of liberal ideology, maybe some anti-police sentiment that we see in areas that aren't faced with the worst effects of crime, right? So it's maybe one of those places. And what did the township do? They passed a resolution prohibiting the flag, right? And this was like just aimed at the thin blue line flag. So they passed a resolution prohibiting display of the flag by township employees, like on duty. So if you're on duty, you cannot display the thin blue line flag. You can't have it on any of your personal items. You can't have it on a shirt. You can't put it on township property. No thin blue line flag anywhere else. If you read the decision, you could have a thin blue, thin red line flag. You could have a don't tread on me flag. You could have any number of other flags if you wanted. None of them were prohibited by this resolution. This was aimed solely at the thin blue line flag. So lots of problems. Why did the township do this? They argued, they said that those restrictions were necessary to maintain public confidence in police and to promote public safety. Now, if there was a crisis of confidence in the Springfield Township Police, that was news to the Springfield Township Police. It was news to a lot of folks there, where it was a community where, it was a nice place to live, not a lot of crime. People respected the police. It's that kind of place. But somehow, the township officials determined that this restriction was necessary to maintain public confidence. What did the police do in response? They sued, and the Pennsylvania State Lodge of the FOP initiated that lawsuit on behalf of the officers in Springfield Township, and they successfully challenged the policy. And the court determined at the district court level that the policy prohibiting the display of the flag by police officers violated the First Amendment. If you know what the general standards are for First Amendment review, there's a Pickering balancing test that dates back to Pickering versus Board of Education, decided by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1968. It's basically a three-prong test, right? Any type of speech by a public employee, we ask three questions. One, was the person speaking as a private citizen or as a public employee? And if they're speaking, expressing as a private citizen, that's protected. Two, are they speaking about a matter of public concern, as opposed to like a private grievance or gripe? And three, then, we balance their right to say what they want to say versus the government's right to run an efficient operation. That's essentially a Pickering balancing test. And so the district court applied those standards and said, these are officers expressing, their opinion on supporting police and how that's important to the success of their community. So certainly that's a matter of public concern expressed in their capacity as private citizens. And that the township didn't show how that expression impacted their operations. On appeal to the Third Circuit, basically arrived at the same conclusion. This is the appellate court, appellate level federal court. The next level up would be the U.S. Supreme Court. The township appealed the district court's decision to the Third Circuit, and on January 28th of 2025, the Third Circuit affirmed the lower court. And the Third Circuit applied the balancing test and said that in this case, the township did nothing to show how the fact that this 40-member police department had a new logo with the thin blue line flag in any way affected any aspect of their government operations, right? No citizen complaints, nothing. And so, from the Third Circuit's perspective, it wasn't a close call. They applied the balancing test, and the officers were successful. One other reason why we're talking about this case is because most First Amendment litigation that we see it arises in a discipline position, right? So somebody posts something on social media, there's a consequence, they're fired. Or they're transferred or something, and they sue the employer, right? That's usually how these cases come up, and the court will apply the same Pickering test. In some instances, we don't wait until somebody is disciplined, and that's a situation where the courts will describe as a prior restraint, and that's what the officers in Springfield Township were faced with in their case. They didn't wait until somebody said, "Screw you, I'm gonna." Display my flag and then get disciplined and fired. They say, no, you've imposed this new rule that has restrained everybody's speech, right? Every police officer in the township has been limited, right? Has been chilled with respect to how they can express themselves. And when an employer does that, their burden is going to be greater than it would be in an isolated discipline case. The court isn't just going to consider, like in a Facebook case, they're going to look at just this one post or these 10 posts that an officer made that were, offensive or whatever. No, when it's a prior restraint, the court has to consider every possible, aspect of expression that affected officers, could engage in, and look at whether or not that speech would be chilled or not. And so it's a much more difficult test for employers to satisfy. And we'll see it sometimes in cases like this. Sometimes you'll also see it when maybe there's a new social media policy that's imposed. Most employer social media policies in the public sector are probably illegal. They're all like a little bit illegal, which is kind of like being a little bit pregnant. But usually they're not challenged because honestly, a lot of unions say, well, we don't really want to incentivize our people to go out and post a lot of stupid stuff on social media, so they don't challenge them. But you do see some cases out there where unions have challenged social media policies as an unlawful prior restraint. And most of those challenges are actually successful. And so the Springfield Township thin blue line flag is a pretty good one. It correctly applies the Pickering balance test, and it's doubly interesting because it gives us a somewhat unusual situation in which we're dealing with a prior restraint as opposed to after the fact discipline. Okay, let's take a quick break, and when we come back, I'll be joined by Lance LaRusso. Lance will tell us a little bit about what's going on with his Thin Blue Line Lawyer Institute and specifically what they're going to talk about at their Force Forum coming up in May in Georgia. And then Lance and I are going to dissect a pretty interesting and current case that's currently pending before the United States Supreme Court related to police uses of force. It's called Barnes v. Felix. And hope you'll stick around and join us for that discussion. Okay, we're back. Welcome back, everybody, for the next part of the podcast. This is the fun part where I don't have to talk as much, which is great. And you can see I'm joined by really one of the best lawyers in the country when it comes to representing first responders, and his name is Lance LaRusso. Lance, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. I've been excited about this for a while.
It's great. I hope we can just make this a regular thing. We loved having you on last year, and I'm so pleased that you were willing to grace us with your presence again this year. And I really mean it. Myself, Lance really is, one of the top folks in the field. And he, in addition to his work as a lawyer, he's got that extra level of credibility. He worked as a police officer, so he knows all sides of things. And Lance has handled probably hundreds, right, of use of force cases, critical incident cases. And the thing that I really like about Lance is he's a lawyer's lawyer, and that's a compliment. But he's also really active in teaching and education. And if any of you have ever, if you haven't ever heard of the Blue Line Lawyer Institute, check it out. www.bluelinelawyer, I think, .com will take you there. They put on, Lance puts on a force forum every year down in Jekyll Island in Georgia. And it's fantastic. A couple of day real deep dive into, all aspects of critical incidents, with a little different flavor every year. I think this one's going to be in May 20 to the 22nd. So
May
Lance, let
20th
me
to the
ask
22nd.
20th to the 22nd. Let me ask you a little bit about like what's going on this year, at the Force Forum. And maybe you can tell us like a broader view, like what do you guys do generally, in the education theme at Blue Line Lawyer Institute? Let's start there.
Yeah, so it's an honor to come back. I really enjoyed the last one, and it was, you and I have run into each other. As I say, when you're always running into good people, you must be in the good spot and in a good point in your life, and you're doing the right things. So the Blue Line Lawyer Institute was founded about 4 years ago as a think tank. We have plenty of people trying to find out how to put our officers in jail for doing their jobs, how to find ways to sue them, how to destroy qualified immunity, how to tell them how to do their jobs. But what we were lacking was a think tank where we could get together with police, trainers, administrators, whoever on the law enforcement side wanted to come, and the lawyers who represent them. And that's what was really different, because getting all the folks in the same room really gave us a chance to say, all right, we're going to have really frank discussions about this. So I've represented right at 180 officers who've been involved in shootings and critical incidents. My firm has probably represented well over 350. And what we've
Wow.
put together is this mix of what are we dealing with? It's very similar to the force science going into the interactions and measuring human force interactions. What we're talking about is, how do you defend these? How do you look after the officer? It's everything from the officer resiliency to how does this affect the individual officer? So every year, there's a few things we do. Number one, we try to go someplace fun. We're on Jekyll Island, which is a great place on the Georgia coast at the Georgia Convention Center, May 20th through 22nd. As you said, you can go to bluelinelawyer.com and sign on. We have an early bird and then a special discount. And we also have an FOP
Great.
discount, because if you are not a member of the FOP and you don't have the FOP legal defense plan, then I hope to God you have something to protect yourself, because it's an unlimited legal defense plan and I haven't seen anything better. So I think one of the issues with what we try to get together is recognizing that this is a person. This is an officer who went to work saying, I'm going to obey my oath. I'm going to honor my oath. I'm going to take whatever society has to throw at me, and I'm going to make a decision based on the training I was given, based on the morals that I have, based on the law, and then based on my best ability to manage this craziness that's unfolding in front of me. As they stated in Graham versus Connor, tense, uncertain, and rapidly evolving circumstances. So every class, every session we have done, this is our fourth one. We always have an officer who, as I say, has been through the ringer. The first year we had Betty Shelby, who came up and spoke. Betty Shelby was a Tulsa, Oklahoma police officer who was forced to shoot and kill a man, charged, she was indicted, and she was ultimately acquitted. People can see the video. It's the one where it's filmed from the helicopter, and you can see the officer using deadly force. Unadulterated, standing in front of a group, talking about her story. What's it like to be whisked away from your house because of death threats? What's it like to stand trial? What's it like to have a security detail to go in and out of court? We also brought Scott Wood, who is an absolutely outstanding law enforcement advocate and former cop. Those cops who go to law school, none of them are worth a flip, but we got them all over the place. So we're trying to manage them as best we can. Scott is a great friend.
And most of them won't admit that they're lawyers.
Yes, well, we all paired across. But Scott is an outstanding litigator, an outstanding police advocate. So he stood up there with his client and told his story. What was it like going through this? And then we are very focused on officer resiliency and not to bring us down at all. But the bottom line is, I have been to enough police funerals. I have been to more police funerals than anyone should go to over suicide. So anything we can do to recognize the resilience that's necessary to get past one of these catastrophic events when your world turns upside down is very, very important. So this year, what we're focusing on is the investigation. Last year was the first 96 hours after the event. We came up with 96 because it's more than 48. It's kind of bringing that point that this is going to last a long time. This is a massive investigation, starting with a basic premise at Blue Line Lawyer Institute we have. A five-year-old could solve who did it. These are not whodunits. Why done it? They are all about the why. So this time we're going to talk about crime scenes, what to look for, how to deal with a situation where you have a conflict prosecutor coming in, and what we're going to deal with so far as changes of venue and this whole struggle we go through with that. Because it's just as important for the lawyers to know the strategies on that as it is for the officers who are stuck in it. And the police chiefs who are sending their folks out into that same community every day with more threats coming in. We're also going to be talking about some very cutting-edge research from for science that has never been revealed before about human interactions and assaults and ambushes, because this is the reality. These are not situations where we see on TV where officer chases bad guy turns around, shoots, officer shoots, and they both miss each other, and then they go to jail. This is reality. This is nitty. This is dirty. These are situations that happen in low light and no light, and they have lasting effects for officers. So that's what the Blue Line Lawyer Institute's about. We have had some webinars. We've done some podcasts with people like this to get the word out, but really focused on the fact that these cases are different. And if you prepare by waiting until one happens to you, you're in trouble.
And it's not just that they're different, and they are, right? It's that they're infrequent. And so that is a really, really, problematic combo, right? So because they are, despite what, depending on what news outlet you go to, these are very infrequent, especially as a percentage of police interactions, very, very infrequent, incidents, which means that we don't have a lot of experience. Experience is everything. And so there aren't many lawyers who do a lot of this work. And so if you're a lawyer, and we have lawyers, a lot of lawyers who listen to this podcast, if you're a lawyer, in this area and you haven't attended the forum, I recommend, highly recommend that you do that. It really is like I'd say a fraternity, but there's lots of great women who do the work. Of folks who do this and have enough experience, that they really understand how it works.
Yeah, and that's a great point. I want to expound on a second because we have the infrequency leads to a very interesting situation where you have somebody who does some police practices stuff, or they're a criminal defense lawyer, and their heart goes out and they're like, "Hey, I don't think this officer did anything wrong. Small town USA, I'm going to defend this person." They're different from the moment you get the call to how you present the evidence in court. And it's pretty much all we do at our firm. We do some catastrophic personal injury cases, wrongful death cases, and then the other side is this other. And we have had officers where we've been involved helping their counsel. And I do a lot of expert witness work. I'm actually still sworn as an officer, but getting involved either as an expert or behind the scenes telling the lawyers, look, you're going to cross-examine somebody who teaches people how to shoot folks. And he's going to get up there and say, your client did it wrong. You have to understand how to cross-examine that person to say, if these are the standards, they were applied correctly. So, being able to get involved when somebody stands up in that small community, and has to go to the Denny's and have lunch around the community defending a police officer who may be very unpopular, my heart goes out to him.
Well, and it could be the best. I mean, normally the, probably the best defense lawyer in the county, hopefully. And that's one of the great things, working with police. And I get to our pra I our practices, like they just barely intersect, it's a, which is so interesting, because we do different things, like in the same, kind of general practice, representing your first responders. I don't try these cases. Right. I'll be involved in the on the admin side and the discipline side and dealing with the after effects of that. But it with respect to getting to dealing with officers, when we've got criminal charges or defending them in civil rights cases, that's not what I do. And fortunately, but when I get to go around and work with police groups, we always make sure that they've got the, the best criminal, they know who the best criminal defense lawyers are in their jurisdiction. All the cops know who the good ones are, who the bad ones are. And fortunately, the good ones like to represent and they like to hold out. Hey, I'm the guy that when the police have trouble, they call me. So usually we can get, the good ones. But that said, even if you're the go-to defense attorney for the police in your county, how many shooting cases have you worked on? It's its own thing, and it's really, really important that we make sure that those folks are educated in the same way that at LRAS stuff, where we teach investigations on the admin side, fortunately, this doesn't happen that much, right? But unfortunately, it means that there's not a lot of experience with investigations. Once you get outside of the big cities, a lot of the folks who are going to be investigating, doing the admin side, and maybe they shouldn't be doing an admin investigation, by the way, in those first 96 hours or whatever, but they don't know that, and they create all kinds of problems by doing that. But it there really is a lack of experience, so it's important to rely on experts. And so that's why, hey, the forum's great, and hey, Jekyll Island's not a bad place to go either.
No,
So
definitely not. And you talked about the infrequency, and I want to touch on that just for a second. So, and you and I were talking about this in Vegas. So, officers make 12 to 13 million custodial arrests a year. Now, I'm not lawyering up on that. I'm not talking about, well, a ticket is technically an arrest. I'm talking about put the handcuffs on, do not pass go, do not collect $200. You go to jail, have to bond out. Or in some places, you just turn around and walk back out of the jail. That's a different podcast. But so,
I'm in
often,
Philadelphia, as you
yeah,
say
so there you go. So,
that, right?
but officers shoot and kill less than 1,000 people a year. And for every arrest, every custodial arrest, the statistics are between 6 and 10 citizen encounters for every arrest. Now, I don't do math in front of people. I'm a litigator, so I divide by three, but that's about it. But if you look at 12 to 13 million custodial arrests a year, and you're looking at 6 to 10, that's somewhere over 100 million law enforcement interactions a year, and we shoot and kill less than 1,000 people. And that number really hasn't moved. And what you do is so vitally important to form that basis that these officers can work in an environment that they trust and they know where the parameters are, they know where the guardrails are. And I've had officers that we've represented in those administrative proceedings, and they say, man, I thought the worst day in the world was getting fired. Actually, the worst day in the world was when I did my job, I had to shoot and kill someone, and everybody said I did something right.
Right. I mean, it's well, that's why we're talking about this stuff. It's incredibly important work, and it's just at that 1,000 a year is, I get in trouble for suggesting that, it probably should be higher, and we might have a safer country, but I'm
Well,
not
there's
allowed
a
to say that.
hesitation factor. I will say this. I will
That it
say
gets people killed.
that if you grab, and I've been teaching all over the country, and I was fortunate enough to speak to the Canadian Police Association a few years ago. Cops are cops. There were cops from seven countries there, and they're cops are cops, and definitely in the hospitality room, all cops are the same. But when you ask that question, and this is it, and I would encourage anybody who goes to a police conference to ask this. How many of you could have used deadly force and didn't? Either because the circumstances changed, you were able to change the dynamic, or the suspect just gave up. I have never seen a class where 70 to 80, 90% of the class did not raise their hands and say, absolutely.
No, I mean, you did the job. It's not the, you don't sign up so that you can shoot somebody, right? That's not the goal.
Absolutely.
Well, so I want to ask, it's great that you're able to come on to talk about this stuff because we try to talk about cases on the podcast and we report out and talk about it in our seminars and stuff, but we got a biggie
Yeah.
on the Supreme Court's docket that we're waiting for a decision from the court in Barnes v. Felix. And so I thought that it would be good, since you're the guy, right? I thought it would be good to talk to you maybe a little bit about that case and about three terms that get thrown around a lot, and there's some overlap and there's a lot of confusion. We can talk about them as we kind of as we go through, but totality of the circumstances, right? Moment of risk, police created danger, right? All very important, and very easily confused and conflated by the court, especially the Fifth Circuit, actually, in this case. So let me give a little to our listeners with just a little bit of a background, factual
Sure.
background of the case, and then maybe we can get your take on what we should be looking for when the court drops its decision. And usually listeners, May and June is when the bulk of these cases get issued. This one, I wouldn't be surprised if it was dropped a little early because I don't think it's going to be a close one, based on how the oral argument went. But so we got to go back to 2016 in this particular case, and the officer involved in this matter's name is Roberto Felix, and we had a shooting on the Harris County Tollway, so kind of toll road. And in fact, there was a toll violation. And so I'm guessing it's like the equivalent of an easy pass, a Sun Pass, whatever that is. We've got a car, which was a rental car. It's a Ashton Barnes was the driver of the car. His girlfriend had rented the car a week before. Whether they were going to steal it or not, I don't know, right? But we had a rental car on the highway, toll violation. So I'm imagining blowing through the easy pass, not paying the toll. Felix hears that come over the radio. He spots the car. It's a Toyota Corolla. He initiates a stop, lawful stop. Barnes pulls over on the left side of the median area. This is all on dash cam, by the way. If anyone wants to watch the use of force, just Google Barnes v. Felix dash cam. It's on the record. The dash cam's in the record in the case, obviously, but anybody can see it. Felix approaches the vehicle, requests documentation. Barnes doesn't have any documentation. Oh, it's my girlfriend's car. I don't have anything. He's kind of starts rooting around in the car, which every officer loves. Felix prompts, says, "Knock it off. Stop doing that. What do you have?" He smells marijuana. Barnes suggests that, oh, you know what? Maybe that stuff is in the trunk. Because that's where everybody keeps their license and their owner's card and their insurance, right? You keep it in the trunk, right? But Barnes suggests, oh, yeah, it might be in the trunk. Let me pop the trunk and maybe you can get it from there. I would imagine that Felix knows what is probably going to happen next. Barnes pops the trunk, shuts the car off briefly. And almost immediately after that, restarts the car, right? And with the hope that Barnes is going to back off. I'm going to pretend I'm going to get it, or I'm sorry, Officer Felix is going to back up. Barnes is going to start like maybe he was going to exit the vehicle. And instead, he takes off. And so this all happens in the course of seconds, right? So it always does. And watch the footage. Officer Felix notices as this happens. He's in the doorway. He steps on the basically the floor plate of the vehicle. The vehicle starts moving in order to protect his own life. He gets his other foot up, and there's a struggle, and I think he fires his service weapon twice, and Barnes was killed. It's basically the facts of the case. It boils down to Barnes is going to try to escape, and Felix, for fear of his life, attempts to stop that and discharges his weapon. Any facts that important facts that I might have left out there, Lance,
So
that
it's
you'd like
really
to?
interesting. I don't think you did, and there's a really interesting point. And I know we have folks that have taken their jobs very seriously, and the clearly established law, an understanding clearly established law means to a lot of officers, I need to go read the cases. So the Fifth Circuit opinion, if I can, is
It's a
no,
terrible
you can go on
opinion.
the Fifth Circuit. Yeah, you can go on 22-20519, 22-20519. It was issued 1/23/24. So that's the docket number. And then the case was argued U.S. Supreme Court January 22nd of 2026. They even state in the Fifth Circuit that the facts are not in dispute, which I've almost come to a point when I hear the facts are not in dispute, there's probably something in dispute. And what's really amazing, it's caught on video, but the Fifth Circuit has a timeline that is so impressive to see, and just harkens back to the amazing language out of Graham versus Connor. The traffic stop, he's told to, well, Felix orders Barnes to open the trunk lid at 2:45, 28, and 21 seconds later, the shots are fired.
That's right.
We have a 21-second span. The only thing that I would add to the facts, and it's really interesting because if we remember with Scott versus Harris, the Supreme Court, first time they admitted a video into evidence, it became part of the record of an appellate court. And they said, and from thenceforth, the court said, we're not going to ignore what we can see on the video. Interesting, because what you can see on the video may not be what the officer saw in the video. But there's this 800-pound gorilla in the room on that video, and no one mentioned it. You can actually go on the website and pull down the Supreme Court argument.
Yeah.
And I've and
I've listened to it.
lawyer, lawyers kill trees. That's what we do.
Yeah.
You can listen to it or you can read it. But the significant fact is that the traffic stop took place on the left side of the roadway.
Yeah.
Now, all of your traffic folks are going, whoa, 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 is there a median? Yes, there's a massive concrete median wall.
Right.
Any police officer that sees a suspect take off, a reasonable concern would be, is he going to ram me into the wall? In 2021, we had a Holly Springs police officer, Joe Burson, murdered by a suspect who literally drove him into, trapped him in the car, and then drove him into a guardrail and literally just destroyed his body, killed him. So there was much about why Officer Felix jumped on the side of the
Yeah.
car, and no discussion whatsoever with an explanation for that. And I'll let you get into what the moment of threat doctrine was, but that's the
Yeah.
only thing that I would add. And that's one of the things we were talking about, that these cases are different. I think ultimately it goes back to the Fifth Circuit with some instruction.
It will,
But
yeah.
and I think you're right with that, because that the moment of threat doctrine we can go into next is a minority view. But when you talk about the totality of circumstances, you heard it here first. I think Felix still gets qualified immunity because of the threat he was facing. He's probably, you look at the video, cameras all distort distance because they use because of the lenses they use. Maybe 5, 6 feet, maybe 4 feet, maybe 3 feet between the passenger side of that vehicle and that concrete wall. And if he
Yeah.
hits it when the driver takes off, he's dead.
Yeah. And I encourage people to watch it if they haven't watched the video, watch it. And it is interesting that, I mean, you talk about this at Force Forum, It's not what the video shows, it's what the officer experienced.
Exactly.
But, you know, look, we're not going backwards on that. And, you know, I feel like I'm watching TV half the time in arbitrations and discipline cases, and, you know, because we're just,
And bad TV at that sometimes.
let's go to the tape.
Yes.
And it tells us some stuff. It doesn't tell us everything. But it exists, and so we can't ignore it. In this particular case, so I gave you the facts. There was litigation after the fact. Let me, you know, let's give some credit to the city. They didn't come out and throw a big check and say, please don't sue us, right? You know, which happens all the time, even when there's no liability on the
Very
employer's
true.
part.
And grand jury refused to indict.
Yeah. Oh, no. I mean, very quick analysis to this. No criminal charges at all. There was a civil suit. The city defends the civil suit. I think it was decided at the district court level. It's on summary judgment. And then it goes up to the Fifth Circuit. And so, yeah, now let's get to these three terms. And I guess we should start with totality of the circumstances, Lance. And like, where does that come from? Right? You know, we'll leave us a little history lesson on the importance of the totality of the circumstances in looking at an officer's use of force.
So all goes back to 1989, Graham versus Connor, and the big earthquake for Graham versus Connor for lawyers, because we're all nerds, was not the case itself, but what Graham versus Connor said, and if you think about it, this is a little over 30 years ago, said that all use of force by law enforcement, whether it's deadly force or non-deadly force, will be evaluated under a Fourth Amendment reasonableness standard. Now that was a sea change. I'm not going to turn this into a law lecture, but Johnson versus Glick, there were plenty of other cases that was decided and settled that there would be a Fourth Amendment analysis when force is used by law enforcement. Okay. So that's very critical here because what the court said, we are going to look, number one, at the totality of the circumstances. Number two, how they appeared to a reasonable officer on the scene, not a reasonable person. Number three, we are not going to evaluate them with the benefit of 20/20 hindsight. And what has narrowed down over the years, and there's a very recent case, the decision came out today, where what is the totality of the circumstances? Well, in the Fifth Circuit, they use the moment of threat doctrine. They literally say at the instant force was used, and they even say the 1 or 2 seconds before the trigger was pulled. What was the circumstance facing the officer and did he act appropriately? And that's where the Fifth Circuit said yes. The plaintiffs are saying that violates Graham versus Connor and the two or three minority jurisdictions that follow that violates Graham versus Connor because you're not looking at the totality of the circumstances. The tension in the law, and a great book, Sandra Day O'Connor, The Majesty of the Law, she talks about this tension. The tension in the law is what we have done over the past 36 years to describe those totality of circumstances. Plaintiffs want to say, we're going to go back to the beginning of time when these two individuals encountered each other. And if the officer used better tactics, if the officer foreclosed the opportunity for the suspect to assault, therefore, there would be no assault. The problem with that is, and I'll tell you about a Camden County case that was just no build. But the problem with that is, all of these factors, all of these arguments ignore the three Graham factors, which was the severity of the crime at issue, whether the suspect poses an immediate threat, and whether the suspect is actively resisting. The plaintiff's bar and the people suing law enforcement saying, totality of the circumstances. If the officer did better, use better tactics, they're ignoring that the suspect controls the interaction. Almost invariably, you control the interaction. So the moment of threat doctrine is going to be challenged because maybe it's too narrow, but what has happened is an exposition of you can't go so far back to say, well, the traffic stop wasn't done properly. Because you can't shoot at officers. You can't drag them with a car.
Right. And so we have, totality of the circumstances, kind of the umbrella, the overarching term. And some of this came up in the argument in this particular case. And I, by the way, listeners, if you haven't ever done this, if you go to oyez.org, oyez.org, that's a great source for information on every single Supreme Court
Absolutely.
case. You can listen to argument, you can read the briefs, you can, it's just a fantastic source. I've spent way too much time listening to oral arguments at the Supreme Court on that website when I should have been like watching The Sopranos or something.
Well,
But,
and I'll tell you something else. I was flying back from a deposition in California, and I was trying to live stream it because you can actually listen to it live. So all the trainers listening, you can get this stuff within minutes of the Supreme Court arguments. I mean, that's just invaluable.
It's super. It's really, I mean, it's very, very interesting to listen to that stuff. And you just didn't, I was in law school. I was down in Washington, so we would go. I could go.
Oh,
You could
wow.
listen in person, which is kind of neat. But I mean, that was the only way you'd hear that stuff back then. So it's there's a lot of access to this stuff now. It's really helpful. And but so the court talked a lot about this. And so, but we've got totality of the circumstances, and then we've got these two terms that you mentioned. And the question is, what is the totality? How far back do we go in the totality to apply the appropriate standard? And so folks on the side of the issue, right, the plaintiff's attorneys and folks who want to expand the set of circumstances in which an officer will be liable or maybe criminally charged in the wake of uses of force will say that we want to go back pretty far, and there's this notion of officer-created danger, right? I mean, and there's got to be that's the you asked for it. You shouldn't have, well, what'd you do that for? Why'd you approach him in the first place? And those are arguments that are raised in the context of these cases. And in fact, in this case, in Barnes v. Felix, that's what they were attempting to do below. I mean, they're attempting to say, well, he shouldn't have jumped on the car. Right? I mean, we want to get into that. We don't want, if it's the totality of the circumstances, we can explore in the litigation whether the officer put himself, inappropriately put himself in position where he had to use force. And they try to avoid that at argument, but that's exactly what they want to do, right? That's exactly.
And it's interesting because in Graham versus Connor, another thing that they said, and I was fortunate enough to get sworn into the U.S. Supreme Court a few years ago. It's a tremendous honor. And one of the things that they say in Graham versus Connor is what may seem reasonable on the street may not seem reasonable in the safety of the judges' chambers. Now, the security at the Supreme Court is staggering. So when a Supreme Court justice writes alone in his or her office talking about the safety of a judge's chambers, they know of what they speak. So the interesting issue with jumping on the car, what may have seemed reasonable at the time to the officer to avoid that big concrete wall behind him, that gets to what we talked about in Graham versus Connor. Officers make split-second decisions under circumstances that are tense, uncertain, and rapidly evolving about the amount of force that is necessary in a situation. What's missing from Graham, you can substitute in what tactics, what movement would be appropriate in a given situation. So, in going back and saying, well, we're going to second guess and say if the officer had done this, if the officer had done that, then we'd be okay. It's contrary to Supreme Court precedent, but it goes a step further because on the other side is the whole anti-law enforcement group. Well, just let them drive away, and that's great. It's kind of like the folks that said we're gonna ban, in some cities and states have said we're gonna ban traffic stops unless it's a moving violation, and that's your policy. And as long as you're okay with Timothy McVeigh and Ted Bundy still being at large, knock yourself out, eat popcorn on your couch with your doors locked, because both of them were captured from equipment violations.
And the court, I mean, some of the justices, I mean, they're aware of that, and so it's interesting to, that's why I love listening to argument, because you can hear you can hear where the justices are coming from.
They don't pull punches either when they're up there.
No, they don't. And it's and you'll have a decision. The decision is going to be a button-down decision, but an argument, it goes a lot of places. And let me read. So this is Justice Kavanaugh on the point you just raised, Lance. So I'm quoting from argument. So this is a question to plaintiff's counsel. I'm just curious, after this case gets resolved on remand, if it goes back on remand, that should tell you right now, right? That's what everybody was thinking about. So after this case gets resolved on remand, if it goes
Reserve a
back on
parking
remand,
space down at the Fifth Circuit. Yeah,
right.
absolutely.
After this goes back, I'm curious what the rule will be for officers and what those training manuals will say. So let's put aside the abducted child example, and there was discussion about when is it okay to jump on a car. Someone's pulling away. It might just be they don't feel like they want to be hassled for a traffic violation, but they could be, about to drive down the street in New Orleans, right, with a bomb, right, or trying to kill people. Quote, you don't know. Or they might be on drugs and about to kill someone else who, is on a bike on the side of the road. And I don't know what we want officers to do. And I don't know how that's going to get fleshed out. But I'm not, officers, if they're held liable for jumping on cars for anything that happens thereafter, are just going to let cars go. And maybe that's the rule the United States thinks is appropriate. I don't know. And and counsel said, no, that's not the rule that we're, but I mean, that's the sense here. Well, is that what you're saying that we want officers to do? Nothing. And it gets to the meat of this, which is these are really, really, really important decisions that officers have to make in no time at all. These are real-time decisions, and the court has, at least for the last 30 years, taken the appropriate view of that and taken that into consideration. And there's this attempt to maybe whittle that down. Now, I think we both kind of know the outcome here, but what do you think is going to happen? Based on what we heard and the arguments here, what do you think the court is going to do with the appeal? And by the way, the question on appeal, which I think is they kept going back to, and I do think it's important. It was a very limited question before the court, probably too limited. If you ask
And the
me,
justices seem to struggle with that a little bit.
yeah, they sure did, right? And so the question before the court is, quote, should courts apply the, quote, moment of the threat doctrine when evaluating an excessive force claim under the Fourth Amendment? So that's the question before them. Lance, what do you think the answer is going to be?
I think you're going to see an answer that says something similar, that the officers have to evaluate what's in front of them. But the moment of threat is too narrow. And they're going to send it back to the district court. And the reason I said get a parking space in front of the Fifth Circuit is they're going to appeal it right back to the Fifth Circuit. I don't think the court's going to take it again. But I think what you're going to see is go back as the district court. We want you to expand upon this and move that area. Move that timeline, if you will, back. And if I can, and I know that we're somewhat limited on time, I want to call. Because I want to give a realistic application of where this can go. If your audience looks at a Camden County, Camden County case, it was a shooting that occurred on October 16th, 2023. The officer was Aldridge, Staff Sergeant Buck Aldridge. It's right on this video of it. It's right on the Georgia-Florida border, and not too far from where we're having the force forum, actually, which is kind
There
of
you
odd.
go.
So the officer pulls over a car being driven by Leonard Cure. He's going over 100 miles an hour, and he pulls the car over, and he is extremely uncooperative. The driver's extremely uncooperative. He is talking to the driver, and the officer and the driver are not getting along well. This is odd. You and I have been doing this a long time. The facts sometimes are crazy. Mr. Cure had just been released from prison after 16 years of serving a sentence for which he was exonerated and he was released.
Oh, wow. Is that right?
Right. So he was released from prison. He was improperly in prison. He was released
Mm-hmm.
of all criminal liability. So during this confrontation, there the Mr. Cure, the driver, grabs the officer's chin and starts wrenching his neck back. Taser was ineffective. The officer tries to hit him with a baton. It's not effective. And he is literally pushing the officer's neck back, shouting some not so stuff about him, and telling him just, I think it's take that bitch or something like that. The officer is on the side of the road. He's alone. His neck is being extended backwards, which not only compresses your trachea, but it makes it hard to breathe, but it also can fracture your neck. If you hyperextend your neck far enough, it can do serious damage. The officer shot him once and killed him. The argument in that case, and you're going to see it because the lawsuit's been filed, was that the officer, and this gets to this totality of circumstances, moment of threat, no doubt. Officer, now somebody may say, well, open hands, firearm, it's defendable all day long, qualified immunity. But if we look at the totality of the circumstances, some people are going so far back and saying the officer was rude and authoritative, overly so, when he got out of the car. That triggered Mr. Cure, who had been in prison for a long period of time, into the attack. And that's the other end of this analysis. And that's one of the things we keep telling people, that they need to advocate for the fact that it is never appropriate to assault a law enforcement officer, to drive away from a law enforcement officer. You have to follow the law.
All this stuff is rooted in the officer created danger stuff. I mean, there is a place for that level of analysis. I'll tell you where I think it is. But in this context, we forget that the officer is a victim of a crime in every one of these situations.
And the officer
And
created
you're
jeopardy, by the
blaming
way.
the crime, the officer crime victim, and you're blaming the crime victim for putting themselves in position where they could become the victim of a crime.
And
And
the
that's
officer
not the way
created
we're supposed to do it.
jeopardy was annihilated in the city of Los Angeles versus Mendez. I mean, it was a Ninth Circuit case. The Supreme Court looked at it. They said officer created jeopardy is inconsistent with our holding in Graham. So what you see in Barnes versus Felix is this, and it's one of the things we love about the law, to practice the law. It's that tension, trying to go back and look at it and trying to exploit. For about 18 years, I represented doctors and hospitals in the middle of all this, but the medical profession, the aeronautics profession, the railroad profession, the construction profession, OSHA, we all go back and do a deep dive. We all go back and say, could we have done it better? But there is a difference between could we have done it better, and because you didn't do it perfectly, you were entitled and should have expected to be, as you pointed out astutely, a victim.
And so what's going to happen with Barnes v. Felix? Because we get to, I like predicting the easy ones. So, look, the court, it's pretty clear the court's going to send it back. And depending on who covers it, and what coverage you're reading or applying, it may seem like this is a win for, the plaintiffs groups. It's not really. It's just going to go back to the Fifth Circuit. The decision is, in my humble opinion, a poorly drafted Fifth Circuit decision. Whenever the lead author is writing in concurrence, and it's just a problematic decision for a lot of reasons. But with some instruction to say, look, moment of the threat is too reduced. Are too focused a view. That's not the same as totality of the circumstances. But, and the question is, what are they going to do after the but? What they're supposed to do is nothing after the but.
Right. And I think what you're getting to, and this is important, is when you said the question's narrow, and what a lot of people listening to don't understand, appellate courts review narrow issues because they're not supposed to be dealing with fact finding. So I think one of the things they're going to be instructing the district court to do is, number one, look beyond the threat. But number two, officer created jeopardy is not going to control this analysis because we ruled in City of Los Angeles versus Mendez. So I think we're going to get an instruction that we can get a toehold in for some more guidance for our officers throughout the United States.
Yeah, that's really the question. Are they gonna, how much guidance are they're supposed to, they are the Supreme Court. They're supposed to provide some guidance to the lower courts. How far are they going to go is what's going to be interesting here. And I don't know exactly how far they're going to go. But I will say, on officer created danger, just since we talked a little bit about your world and my world and how they're kind of concentric circles. All of the officer created danger stuff, it does come into play in an admin. Right. So, when we're through all this, could a police department, after the fact, go through and look at, maybe disciplinary proceedings or something for policy violations? Absolutely. Right. But that's not the use of force, though. Right.
Right.
And so there are ways that, there can be consequences for policy violations, for failures to comply with training. And not every policy violation warrants discipline, right? But some do. And there's a time and a place for that. I don't think this particular Barnes v. Felix fact pattern would be one of those, but certainly there are. And so when people say, well, then there's no consequences for an officer who
No, that's
maybe makes some
ridiculous.
terrible decisions, that's just wrong.
Well,
There's a place for that.
and I'll go a step further because the magic of Garrity. Garrity is one of the few times, I mean, you got Kalkines too, but one of the few times the United States Supreme Court has said, we're going to force you to speak to government agents. But the reason we're going to force you to speak to government agents is it is more important to get to the bottom of what happened so we can adjust our training, our hiring, our supervision than it is to prosecute an officer for a crime or any public official for a crime. So taking that back to the analysis that you mentioned. So we look and say, okay, did this officer act appropriately administratively? That's also incumbent on, did our training fail this officer? Which is one of my pet peeves when the officer does everything they were trained to do, but they still get jammed up. Number two, that second guessing analysis does not belong in a criminal context. So we have had officers that people have prosecuted, indicted, saying, well, if you use better tactics, you would have foreclosed this stone cold criminal from trying to kill you. Now, in Georgia, we have a very interesting statute, and you can look it up. It's 17420, subsection D delta. And I highly recommend that folks try to pull these statutes when you can and change the law when you can. And it states that an agency cannot promulgate laws, regulations, or rules that are more restrictive on the use of force than state law. So you cannot have a small jurisdiction say, well, we're going to do it better and we're going to have a better mousetrap. It's null and void. And when you start taking those little bits of discussions of could we have done it better, and you're going to turn it into what you think should be a multi-million dollar judgment or a criminal prosecution and putting someone in prison. We are actually seeing that across the country with these indictments where prosecutors, who I'm convinced some of them can't spell use of force or OIS, sit here and look at an officer's body camera and say, I think I would have done it differently. So we're going to indict him and tell a grand jury that had they done it differently, they wouldn't have had to use force. That has just got to stop.
Well, and I think, and that's probably a whole other podcast. And I think it is stopping. I think the elections last fall showed us a little bit about what the public thinks about prosecutors who look at life that way. And so maybe you will come back and we can talk about that. But
Love
maybe you'll
to.
come back after we get the decision in this one if there's any interesting wrinkles in there that warrant further discussion. That would be wonderful.
I
But
think it'll be
Lance,
a quick decision. Now, you and
I
I have
think.
both seen this. When something gets sent back and you get a district court judge who says, told you I was right. Yeah, I think you're going to get a very quick turnaround.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to take long here at all. But we shall see. Lance, thank you so much for joining us. I
This has
really
been great.
appreciate
I
it.
appreciate it. My
Oh
honor.
man. Hey, well, come back and see us again, and good luck with the Force Forum, which is when?
May 20th through the 22nd, go to bluelinelawyer.com to sign up.
Awesome. Thanks a million, Lance, and talk to you soon.
Thank you.